Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. So glad you're spending some time with us on this Sunday evening, or whenever you're listening to the program. Tonight, we take a walk on the dark side, exploring the blackened hearts and twisted motives of an assortment of killers, rogues, and scoundrels, a few of whom went on to achieve great things in presumably honorable positions within society, but who were never able to fully escape their colorful and sometimes bloody pasts. Three different authors will be joining us tonight to share with us their insight about the books they've written, the characters they've researched, and I think you're going to learn plenty from all three of these people. I may have mentioned in the past that I've been a news reporter here in Las Vegas for a long time. I arrived in town back in 1979, right at the beginning of the end for the mob here. Actually, it's probably more like the middle of the end, at least the traditional mob, that is, the La Cosa Nostra, the mafia, which had money in nearly every major casino on the Strip. Their influence at one point was enormous. The profits off the charts. Much of it was skimmed right out the back door. A lot of people were killed during that era, shot, stabbed, beheaded, car bombed. As the line says in that movie Casino, there are a lot of holes out there in the desert. One of the casino operators from that era, widely regarded as smart and honest, was a guy named Bill Friedman, who ran two very successful joints on the Strip and who subsequently taught casino management at two universities. He still does casino management expertise that he shares with casinos all over the world. For the past several years, he's been working on a book that explores the bloody roots of the mob, not only as it traces back to Las Vegas, but back to the Midwestern mob families, back to the era of the public enemies, number one, to the corrupt regime of J. Edgar Hoover, and even to the White House itself. Bill has written a page-turner of a book that ties many of these loose ends together in a way that I've never read before. It's called All Against the Law. He will join us in the second half of tonight's program, and having known him for a long time, I can tell you he's a talented storyteller. Before Bill Friedman joins us, we'll hear from a writer who does not want to use his real name. His pseudonym is Stapleton Gray, and he says he has good reasons for not using his real identity. Those reasons are outlined in his book, The Unbelievable True Tales of a Tall Texan. It chronicles his life growing up as the son of a football hero who became a leg breaker for the mob and later a hitman who was on the FBI's most wanted list and died in a hail of gunfire. It's quite a story. But first, the exploits of another legendary Texan, a gambler named Benny Binion, who became an icon here in Las Vegas. Even though he did time in federal prison and admitted that he killed a couple of people along the way, maybe a whole bunch of people, people who dared to cross him or got in his way. Binion's Horseshoe is still operating in downtown Las Vegas, though the family no longer owns it, and its founder is more responsible than maybe any other person for the explosive growth in the poker industry, which has, you know, become, it's emerged from smoky card rooms to become a global multi-billion dollar industry. Benny Binion did that, and we'll tell you how in just about a minute when I'm joined by Doug Swanson, whose new book, Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, is immensely entertaining. So that's the plan. I do want to mention one news item first. This happened just about 2 hours ago. The planet Mars has a new visitor from Earth. The Maven spacecraft successfully made it to Mars earlier tonight, ending a 10-month-long journey through deep space on a mission to help scientists figure out why the red planet changed from a relatively warm and wet place in the ancient past to the cold, arid world it is today. MAVEN, the name stands for Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution, fired its engines in a crucial 30-minute braking burn Sunday night, slowing down enough to be captured by the planet's gravity. That happened about 10:24 p.m. Eastern time. It joins three other operational probes that are in orbit around Mars. It's always kind of a hold-your-breath moment when one of our spacecraft approaches Mars, as listeners to this program know, because a lot of things that have been launched from Earth to Mars have failed right about the time they get there. It's almost been like the place is jinxed or something. In our NAPS news section on the Coast website, webmaster Tim Bedall and I have put together our usual eclectic assortment of stuff. One of the stories posted there is about the Mars mission, a little background on what it hopes to accomplish. Also on our list tonight, an update on cattle mutilations in the West, a new examination of the troubled wild horse program run by the BLM, maybe the worst program in the entire federal government, and that's saying a lot, and a couple of mind benders about cutting-edge physics, one about insider spies, and a tale that sounds perfect for Coast to Coast, the mysterious hellhound. We got a lot of ground to cover tonight, so put on a pot of Joe, jump into those jammies, toss a log on the fire, and let's get comfy for a full slate of wild but true tales about some rough, tough hombres. Back in a moment with my first guest, Doug Swanson. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. When Benny Binion died Christmas Day 1989, I remember thinking that someone should try to get his FBI file, you know, use the Freedom of Information Act to see what's in his file now that he was gone. And so I did. A couple of weeks after he died, I filed this request with the FBI. It took, I think, close to 5 years to get that file. The FBI had told me I was the first guy to request it, and it took them a long time to pull all this material together. And as I recall, it was more than 500 pages of stuff. There were more pages that kept arriving for months afterward. But I always suspected there was more, and now we know there was more because investigative reporter Doug Swanson tracked it down as part of the research for his new book, Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, which is getting rave reviews everywhere it's been read, and for good reason. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. Happy to be here.
Terrific book. Why this one? Had you heard, as you're working the streets as a reporter in Texas, in Dallas, had you heard stories about Binion, or was he too far removed from Texas by the time you came along?
No, I've been around for a long time, and I used to cover police many years ago for the old Dallas Times-Herald, and when I would be at the police station late at night, we'd all be sitting around having coffee, and every now and then talk would come up about Benny Binion, and I just got interested in him that way.
Well, it's you can see why it's a great topic, because your book is entertaining from top to bottom. There's a quote. One of the reviews had a quote in it, and it sort of matches my own feelings about Benny Binion. I got to meet him twice. I was there for one TV interview that was conducted by a friend of mine, and I got to know his sons, Jack and Teddy. There's a quote from one of these book reviews that says, "His philanthropy combined with his endearing corn ponery made him a beloved figure in the valley, and it's hard to not like him even as you read about his ruthlessness." That's sort of how you came around in your thinking about him, right?
Oh, I think so. I was surprised at the end of the process how much I liked the guy, even though he, as you mentioned earlier, did some pretty unsavory things in his life. At the end of all my research, I thought this is a guy who would be worth knowing.
The transformation is amazing. Where he started, what he did, and how he became such an icon here. I mean, beloved. I mean, people wept when he died.
Sure, and there are still people, and I'm running into them even now, who knew Benny and who were very loyal to him and still are loyal to him. He commanded a lot of respect, and I think he was probably the greatest friend you could have and the worst enemy you could have.
That's for sure. So start the tale. Give me the thumbnail sketch about how he started out. I think the phrase you use in the book is he came from nothing.
Sure. He was born in 1904 in a little town in North Texas called Pilot Grove, and it really was nothing. In fact, it burned down a few years after he was born. And when he was in second grade, before he had even learned to read or write, his dad, who was a traveling horse trader, took him with him, and they went out and bought and sold horses together. Soon after that, Benny fell in with roving tribes of gamblers. They would go from town to town and run dice games and card games in these little towns and fleece the local populace and then move on to the next town. And that's where he learned how to run a gambling house, out with these roving dice dealers going from town to town in Texas.
He ends up in Dallas, where I guess he runs something called a policy game. What is that?
That's a lottery. It's a numbers game. He would send out his runners with little policy books. They would have three columns of numbers, and if you wanted to play the game, you'd pick three numbers, and then the runners, the bagmen, would take it back to the home office, and they'd have a drawing. Sometimes it was fixed, sometimes it wasn't, and maybe you could bet 10 cents and win $10. And back in the 1920s and 1930s, that might be some big money.
You know, I remember seeing interviews with Benny and hearing him talk here in Las Vegas. He wasn't shy about saying he did some bad things. I mean, he wouldn't come out and spell it out, but he would say things like, well, I don't need to hire somebody to do killing. I can do my own killing. And there are folks who think that he probably killed a whole bunch of people. Do you have an idea how many?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Benny also used to say tough times make tough people, and that was part of his credo. That's a good question. How many did he kill? He only admitted to killing two. One was a rival bootlegger. The other was a rival policy operator. But there were many other people who crossed Benny Binion or his operation and ended up dead. Maybe dozens? I don't know. It's really hard to get a count. But there certainly were people out there who made an enemy of Benny and didn't live long.
So what was he doing? Consolidating power, eliminating rivals?
Sure, that was doing both. He had in 1936, he started his dice operation, and he had dice games in most of the downtown hotels in Dallas. He was the king of that in the Dallas area, Dallas, Fort Worth, North Texas, and he did it two ways. He made powerful friends in the courthouse and in the police department and in the district attorney's office, and then he controlled his rivals, and by that he either took a percentage of their operation, or if they wouldn't cooperate, they ended up in a hole somewhere.
You write in the book that he was protected, meaning payoffs?
Oh, sure. I mean, the city became dependent on his payoffs. He at one point said he was giving more than $600,000 a year to the city of Dallas in bribes and payoffs. Now, it was laundered a little bit. They would have a show raid on one of his operations and have a fake arrest, and then his lawyer would go down to the courthouse and pay some fines, and some would go into the pockets of the officials and some would go into the government coffers. But that's the way it operated for many years here.
There was a rival named Herb Noble, and this guy had more lives than a cat. I mean, literally more lives than a cat. Tell me who he was and what happened to him.
He was a rival operator in the dice business here in Dallas, and he paid Binion his percentage. But allegedly, at one point, Benny said, I want 25% of your operation, and Noble said, no, that's not going to happen. And right after that, there ensued a series of attempts on Noble's life. People tried to shoot him. They tried to blow him up. He was a pilot, and they put nitroglycerin in the engine of his airplane. That blew up. But they always missed. It became, after a while, like Wile E. Coyote going after the Roadrunner.
But finally, what happened? I mean, well, it was like 11 times. Did they get him?
Yeah, what happened was Herbert Noble became so famous for these attempts on his life that he started getting lots of fan mail from around the world, and he really loved this mail. He would go out to his mailbox every day, every morning, to see what letters had come in that day. And, you know, if you're a hitman, even if you're an inept hitman, you see a pattern there. And so the assassins put a landmine under his mailbox. And so when he drove up to get his mail that day, they set it off. And that was finally the end. After 12 attempts, that was the end of Herbert Noble.
Nobody ever pinned it on Benny Binion. What's your suspicion?
Well, it's an open case. Still, it's never been solved. I mean, you know, Binion's fingerprints were all over this. Everybody believes that it was a Binion's deal. And, you know, at one point, Herbert Noble tried to get Binion. As I said, Herbert was a pilot, and the cops went out to his place one day, found him underneath his airplane, single-engine airplane, welding bomb racks onto the wings. He had two napalm bombs sitting there, and he had a map to Binion's house in his pocket. And his plan was to fly over the house out there on Bonanza Road in Las Vegas and drop two bombs on the house. So even Herbert believed Benny was after him.
I would imagine part of the problem in writing a book about Benny Binion is separating fiction from fact, because there's so many stories about him. There was Jack Binion told me in an on-camera interview one time that Benny met his future wife, Jack's mother, He was driving one day drunk in Dallas, and his car broke down in front of a church. And just as the church was letting out, and he somehow got into a fight with several people, pulled the bumper off the car and beat several people into submission. And that's and one of the people who witnessed this happen was Jack's future mom. And I guess you say in the book that's one that probably didn't happen, at least not that way.
Yeah, you hear it told now sometimes, and it's 14 people who came after him.
That's
and
right.
Standing there like Russell Crowe and the Gladiator, you know, knocking him down. And but you go on back and look at the official reports, and what the reports say is that it was one middle-aged woman that he hit. So, you know, somewhere in there's the truth, but who knows?
You note that he moved from Dallas. He was feeling the heat in Texas, so he moved. He moved to Las Vegas, relocated his operation, and got into the casino business. It's hard to imagine Benny Binion leaving anywhere because of the heat or, you know, feeling pressured that he would back down to anybody.
Well, as I said, he owned the people at the courthouse. Unfortunately, he did not control the voters. And in 1946, they voted in a reform slate, so he lost his sheriff. And he lost his district attorney. And he was told, you either get out of town or you're going to be arrested or killed. So he loaded up his Cadillac with allegedly $1 million in the trunk. He took two guys with him. One of them was R.D. Matthews, a name that may mean something in Las Vegas.
Oh yeah.
They both had Tommy guns, and they drove Benny out to Las Vegas.
So describe Las Vegas at that time, kind of a wide open place in terms of opportunities here. You write in the book that it not only had the mob, it needed the mob.
Yeah, they showed up with capital and they showed up with expertise. And this was, I think, right when modern Las Vegas was being born. This is when the Flamingo went up and, you know, Bugsy Siegel was involved in that. And there were others coming along in that period. And it was just starting to turn into what it would become. And Benny was right there with money and with good timing with all the rest of these guys. And they knew how to run casinos because they'd been running casinos all over the country. They'd been running them illegally, but now they could do it in a lawful way.
Well, that's kind of the story of Las Vegas. All these guys with track records, with criminal records, bootleggers and gamblers who'd done all kinds of illegal stuff came here and got a second lease on life. It was sort of like the ethical car wash, somebody once said.
Yeah, well, Benny was right there with him. I mean, he was part of that wave, and I think his timing was impeccable. He had a lot of money. He knew how to run a game, and he fell right in with the best of them.
You know, it was never clear here, even after he was gone, what his relationship with the actual mob was. I mean, people assume that he coexisted with the mafia, that there was interaction at times over the years. How would you describe it?
I think there was a working relationship that came and went. Now, when he was in Leavenworth for tax evasion in the middle 50s, the mob pretty much took over the horseshoe. Eddie Levinson and others were running the place and were skimming millions of dollars out of the place. Benny came back and was able to buy it back from them. I think he had some respect from the mob. I was talking to Doyle Brunson, the great poker player, in researching this book, and he told me a story about how he got in trouble with Tony the Ant, and Tony the Ant wanted to set up some cheating operation and wanted Doyle to cooperate, and Doyle wouldn't do it. Tony the Ant said he was going to kill him, and Doyle went to Benny and said, I need help, and Benny got Tony the Ant to back off. So that's the kind of power he had.
Wow. Tony the Ant, by the way, for the audience doesn't recognize that nickname, was Tony Spilotro, who was sort of the mob ambassador here in Las Vegas in the 70s and into the 80s. He was in the movie Casino. He was played by Joe Pesci, and he was a very feared and ferocious guy who is rumored to have killed about 22 people. So if Benny Binion could get him to back down, that's pretty amazing. What is not so amazing, if you know Binion, is that he opened a place and was a success. And if he was still in charge of it, it would probably still be a success. I mean, what was the secret to his management prowess?
Well, as you know, George, he didn't have bands there. He didn't have chorus girls. He didn't have comedians or ventriloquists. It was just a gambling joint. And if you wanted to gamble a whole bunch of money, that's where you went. He had great odds, and you could and go to the dice table, you go to the craps game, and put down the biggest bet you had, and Benny would accept it. I was, after I wrote the book, I happened to be talking to Larry Gatlin, the country singer, who was a friend of Benny's, and he was telling me about sitting there at Benny's table in the restaurant one day, and somebody wanted to put down a bet of about $250,000, and the pit boss came running over to Benny and said, can I take this? And Benny said, hell, it's a gambling joint, ain't it? And that was just his philosophy.
There's a bigger story. It was like $700,000. A guy came in with two suitcases, one full and one empty, and he put it on the line and lost it. Yeah, that's I guess the motto is still, they use it in their advertising, good food, good whiskey, good gamble. That was something that Benny had said?
Yes, and he also said treat the little people like big people.
And it worked. When we come back, Doug Swanson will share some more stories, true life stories about the amazing Benny Binion and how he made poker into such a multi-billion dollar global industry. Stick with us. Kind of figured that's got to be a song Benny Binion would have liked. Marty Robbins, Big Iron from 1959, stirring tale of a bad man named Texas Red. We're talking with Doug Swanson, author of Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion. And among the astonishing revelations is the book is the suggestion, based on documents he obtained from the FBI, that late in life, Benny Binion became an informant for the FBI. We'll explore that when we come back right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Doug Swanson, you're a seasoned reporter. How tough was it to get people to open up and talk about Benny Binion? And I ask that in this context, is that people are very protective of him and his story, his legend, his status in the community, even now.
Certainly, and not everybody wanted to talk about him, including some members of his family, but some people did open up surprisingly. I mentioned earlier R.D. Matthews, who was a Vegas figure for quite some time, and he was long said to be the toughest man in Dallas and was alleged to have been one of Benny's hitmen. Now, R.D. was still living in, when I was researching this book here in Dallas. I went out to his house. He was 91 years old. We sat beside a swimming pool for several hours and had a wonderful conversation. Now, many things he wouldn't talk about, but he did talk about a lot of stuff that happened. And it was the same with many people who knew Benny. Some were quite happy to talk about him. Some still won't.
Yeah, R.D. Matthews, I mean, man, even in his 80s, he struck fear into the hearts of people here when he was in town.
Well, I think he was a tough guy. You may know he got shot in the head once by a rival. And the bullet went into his eye and exited at his temple, and he got up and drove himself to the doctor. Now, if you get shot in the head and you drive yourself to the doctor, you're the toughest guy in town as far as I'm concerned.
And the eye patch he wore, it didn't hurt his image as a tough guy either.
Right.
Benny, you mentioned that a lot of people died who were rivals of Benny Binion. He got into a bit of a business dispute with a former FBI agent here, and bad things happened. Coulthard.
Yes, the gentleman Coulthard, Mr. Coulthard, was having a real estate dispute with Binion, and a few days later went out to his car there in the parking garage downtown, and the car bomb went off and killed him. And this was not the first person who had crossed Benny Binion who died in a car bomb.
Ever have any ideas, anything surface in the documents that you got about who his car bombers might have been or whether they worked for Benny at all?
Well, as you may know, the police were looking at Binion for a while and never made the case. In the FBI documents, they made reference to a man named Jim Dolan, who was an old associate of Binion's, and they believed that he had done the bombing and then fled to Mexico, but they never could make a case for that either. Dolan was later killed in a drug deal gone bad in San Antonio, so his tale will never be told, but there was lots of suspicion that Binion was involved, but Benny said, I don't know who blowed him up, but I damn sure didn't. So that was the word from Benny.
I can't remember from the book, but did you ever see the name Tom Hanley in any of the documents or run in anyone who had Hanley stories?
No, I don't remember that.
We'll have to have a conversation about that sometime. So in the how hard was it for you to get the FOIA stuff, the files? How many pages did you get? And as I said, I don't know if you heard in the introduction, I had filed one years ago too, and right after Benny died, but I never got some of the material that you got, so kudos.
Well, thank you, and I'm grateful to you because you paved the way. A lot of the stuff had already been processed, so I was able to get it in a hurry. But, you know, the FBI takes its own sweet time on these things, and some of it was quite difficult. Some of it I had to patch together from other sources, such as the House Select Committee on Assassinations that compiled a bunch of documents. Some of it I'm still waiting for. I'm still waiting for the bulk of Ted Binion's FBI file, which runs to thousands of pages. All I've received so far are about 200 pages, and who knows what's in that thing.
Thousands of pages, wow.
Sure.
And in the FOIA documents, I can remember when they first arrived, going through them really fast and laughing at this designation that they had for Binion. They called him a quote top hoodlum, which is not a phrase you've heard in a long time. Tell me about some things that you saw in there that might have surprised you.
Well, I think what was really amusing was the way that they tried to stake out Binion's house for a while. Now, you know what it's like out there on Bonanza Road. It's not too easy for an FBI agent to hide out there. And so the kids were laughing at them. Hank Greenspun sent out some reporters to expose them. They tried to chase Benny cross-country when he drove from Las Vegas to Texas. They lost him several times, and Benny thought it was all a lark. In many cases, and he was making fun of the agent. So part of the surprise was that the Bureau was so inept. But the bigger surprise, I think, was what you mentioned earlier, that Benny, according to the FBI documents, became an FBI informant in 1960.
Do you have any idea what he may have told them?
I don't think he told them anything all that valuable, at least according to the documents I saw. I think he gave them some information when people were in town or there was a low-level criminal drifting around, that sort of thing. But what J. Edgar Hoover wanted out of Binion was information on who was skimming from the casinos. And I saw no evidence in the records that I got that he ever gave them any information about that.
So he might have cut some sort of a deal to maybe get out of prison earlier or have an easier deal. And I'll tell you what I whatever I find out, and then just didn't find out anything that was useful for him.
Well, and this is the way Benny always worked. He got powerful people on his side. I mean, when he was in Dallas, he had the sheriff on his side, and there in Las Vegas, he manages to get the special agent in charge on his side. That all changed later when Joseph Yablonsky came to town and started running the FBI. As you know, that reversed it entirely. But for a while, he had the top man for the FBI in his pocket.
Some of those documents show that Hoover was looking at this himself, right? He was looking at Benny Binion, reading this stuff himself.
You can see the handwritten notes from J. Edgar Hoover on these documents. In fact, you can see him getting more and more frustrated as the FBI fails to pull off its surveillance. But it's not just Hoover. It goes up to the Attorney General of the United States at the time, and then up to the White House, to Harry S. Truman. There are memos in these files that show that Harry S. Truman was giving the Attorney General and FBI Director Hoover advice on how to pursue Benny Binion.
Your theories on that? Why would Truman pay any attention to that?
Well, there was a scandal in what was then called the Bureau of Internal Revenue, later the IRS, and they had some agents who were shaking down citizens and taking bribes and payoffs. So Truman and the Attorney General wanted to show that they'd gone straight and they were out doing business and going after the bad guys. So they were after Binion as a PR move.
Let's talk about what Binion did. I mean, not only did he run a successful business downtown, but he did a lot of bigger stuff the impact is still being felt in Las Vegas. One was poker. Tell me the story, what he contributed to the poker and the growth of poker.
Sure. In 1969, he and his son went up to Reno to attend something called the Texas Gamblers Reunion, and that was a little poker game at a hotel there, at a casino there. They had assembled some of the great players from the poker underground, like Johnny Moss, Puggy Pearson, Sailor Roberts, Doyle Brunson, and they played poker. And, it was supposed to be a kind of an attraction to bring some people into the casino. It didn't quite work out all that well, but Binion had an idea. He thought, well, why don't we bring these people to the Horseshoe? We'll have them play some games, and that way maybe I can draw some people in to watch them play, and then these people will go over to the tables and lose their money there. It was a publicity stunt that he started in 1970. He never thought it would grow beyond, 50 to 75 players, but, look where it is today.
Yeah, it became the World Series of Poker, and it's, thousands and thousands of players now.
Sure. Moved away from the Horseshoe, and I think I know they need to make money and they want to bring in lots of players, but I went to the World Series of Poker back in the early 1980s at the Horseshoe, and I just loved that atmosphere, that sort of down at the heels, smoky, smells like old beer, bunch of guys sitting around with polyester clothes and long sideburns dealing cards.
Absolutely. I covered a couple of times in those same years, and it just seemed like it belonged there, and now it's too darn respectable.
Right. But, it got big, and boy, the money is huge.
And then rodeo, National Finals Rodeo. Binion
Sure.
played a pretty big role in bringing that to town.
Sure, he brought that to town. I mean, Benny loved horses and cowboys and the rodeo. He had a big ranch up in Montana. He just loved horses. And, anytime any broken down rodeo rider would come through the horseshoe, Benny would comp him a meal and maybe slip him some chips or a little bit of cash. He just loved cowboys, and bringing the rodeo to town was a big deal for him.
And then, of course, now it's a multi-million-dollar event, sort of like the World Series of Poker has become so big. I'll throw out some names that you cover in the book, and you can give me sort of a capsulization about how they connect to Benny Binion. Clyde Barrow, Bonnie and Clyde.
Yes, Binion back in the 1930s had a share of a big casino between Dallas and Fort Worth called Top of the Hill Casino. And it was almost raid proof because it was on top of the hill, hence the name. And they had a guard shack down below. And when the cops would show up to raid them, their alarm would go off. And the gamblers would escape through tunnels, and the dealers would fold up the tables like Murphy beds. And by the time the cops got into the casino, the dealers would be standing there with a hymnal, singing hymns, so acting like it was a church service. So this place went on for years like this, attracted a huge crowd. Celebrities would come out, Buster Keaton, Howard Hughes would be out there. And I was talking to a dancer who used to dance out there back in the 30s, named Willie, and she remembers she was dancing with a troupe called the Texas Rockets. She looked across the floor one day and saw Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow standing there watching her dance. And then when
Go ahead.
Clyde was shot dead in Louisiana, they had his funeral here in Dallas, and Benny chartered a plane, came in low over the funeral, and dropped a wreath on Clyde's grave.
Mo Dalitz.
Well, he and Benny were big friends, and Mo had his own problems, with his past, mob allegations and affiliations. But he and Benny turned out to be very close friends, and there's a picture in the book taken at Binion's Montana Ranch, and it's Steve Wynn, Benny Binion, Ted Binion, and Mo Dalitz out there on the ranch.
Steve Wynn worshipped Benny Binion. I've got a photo of them in my house. It's he learned a lot from him. Says he learned a lot at his knee.
Yeah, I think so. And Binion's daughter Brenda, who talked to me for the book, had some great shots of Wynn hanging out around the horseshoe with Binion. And I think that's true. Obviously, Steve Wynn is a genius in his own right, but I think he learned very young many things from Benny Binion.
Amarillo Slim.
Amarillo Slim was one of the early poker players participating in the World Series of Poker, and he was very telegenic. He could go on the Tonight Show and play the professional Texan and tell those jokes and act like he was a guy just off the range. And he was instrumental in helping publicize the World Series of Poker because the TV just loved that guy.
Benny had to go to prison for a while on tax charges, but that wasn't something that happened here in Las Vegas, right? It was stuff he owed for back in Dallas.
That's correct. You mentioned Herbert Noble earlier in the show. Well, Herbert Noble turned told the cops where to find Benny's records, and they conducted a raid on his Dallas operations and found that Benny was making more than $1 million a year in the gambling income, gambling house income, but was reporting only about a few thousand. And so that caused him some tax problems. He was in Las Vegas when they finally nailed him, but it was because of his Texas operations. That's correct.
And because of that, he couldn't have a gaming license the rest of his life, but it didn't exactly infringe on the family running the place, right?
No, it was a family operation. I think Benny was listed as what, director of public relations or something like that, which is, silly. Although, he was great at public relations, but he clearly was running the place, and he said as much if anyone asked him that he was still in charge.
There was a story that he would go into the kitchen every day and taste the chili that was cooking, and he could taste it well enough to the point where if you had used tap water, he could taste the difference. You ever hear stories like that?
Oh, sure. And that was supposedly the recipe from the Dallas County Jail that he took with him when he went to Las Vegas.
Did he know Siegel, Bugsy Siegel?
Yeah, he loved Bugsy Siegel. In fact, he was there at the opening of the Flamingo, that big disastrous night when the Flamingo had not the crowds it anticipated and some bad weather. But he talked about later how much he admired Bugsy Siegel and thought he was just the nicest, most wonderful guy he ever met. He said that about a lot of mob guys. I call him the Will Rogers of mobsters because he never met one he didn't like, apparently. He was always full of praise for how nice they were and what great guys they were.
He was a central player, although he was on the sidelines of a scandal that involved a federal judge here, Harry Claiborne.
Right. Very close.
They had lunch every day together, I think was the story.
I think that's true. And he and Harry Claiborne were initially on the opposite sides of a murder case, but then Benny hired him, and they became the closest of friends. Now, when I talked to Joseph Yablonsky, the FBI agent who ultimately went after Claiborne, that was one of the things that really puzzled Yablonsky. He came into town, he's looking around, and he sees this federal judge at the table with Binion, who's a convicted felon, and they're laughing it up, as they did, as you say, every day. They were very close.
Yeah, Yablonsky had told us the same thing, is that that's what sort of got him curious about Harry Claiborne and raised all kinds of suspicions. What's your take on Joe Yablonsky? I should tell the audience, for sake of those who don't know that part of it, is he came in sort of as a full of fire and brimstone kind of a guy who's going to clean up this one horse town, and he saw Las Vegas the way a lot of federal agents saw Las Vegas in those days, as a nest of vipers and a corruption quagmire, and he was going to go after some of the people who was responsible, and this federal judge, Harry Claiborne, was one of them.
Yeah, he said he was going to plant the American flag in Las Vegas. I mean, I think he came in with, as you say, these grand designs. He got or helped get Claiborne put away. I've visited with him at his house. He's retired in Florida now. And the sense I have from him is that he doesn't feel he ever got his due, that he really didn't clean up Las Vegas the way he thought he should have, but that he should have been admired and respected for doing what he did, and instead there's sort of a feeling that he got run out of town. Now, I'm not saying I agree with him or disagree with him, but that's the feeling he still has, that he should have been honored. There should be statues put up of Joe Yablonsky as far as Joe Yablonsky thinks, but instead, you mention his name to people like Oscar Goodman now, and you get a spit and a sneer.
Do you get a sense of the relationship Benny to Oscar?
I think it was good. I mean, Oscar still talks highly of him and you know, very admirably. I mentioned this this FBI informant matter to Oscar, and Oscar said, "No, it's not true. I don't believe it. That can't be true." Just shaking his head, saying, "No, you're lying."
You mentioned you'd filed a FOIA request, Freedom of Information, about Ted Binion, the son. He was sort of the guy. He and Jack were running the Binion's Horseshoe for, after Benny went to prison, they sort of ran it. Ted had a reputation as a pretty tough guy, likable, affable, troubled, but could be pretty tough if somebody got out of line in that place. And I remember when I first came to town, it was that was the one place you didn't want to get out of line or do something stupid.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who ran afoul of Ted. One of the FBI documents I did get in Ted's file said that he saw a man in a casino once that he believed had been selling drugs to his sister, Barbara, who had a drug problem. And he said, "I'm going to grease that expletive." And 2 days later, the guy was found dead in the desert. So, maybe something else happened, but certainly there appeared to be a causal relationship there. Other people who were suspected of cheating at the Horseshoe were taken out back and beaten very badly. There was one man who kicked in a plate glass window at the Horseshoe and was shot in the head on the sidewalk outside the Horseshoe. Some people thought Ted did that, but another man pleaded guilty to manslaughter in that case, the pit boss.
Do you have any documentation related to Ted Binion's death that's come through, or is that what the other thousands of pages might be?
Yeah, that's what I'm waiting for, and you know, who knows when that'll turn up. I hope I live that long.
Is that another book?
I don't know. That's a good question. There have been lots of books written about Ted Binion, and there's been a movie and some TV shows, but who knows what's in those records? You know, as you know, George, you open that big box and you go through 500 pages, and it's like panning for gold, and every now and then something turns up.
Well, I got a feeling those other books that have been written about it would pale compared to what you've done, man. Your this book, Blood Aces, folks, you got to check it out. Doug Swanson, thanks for joining us. It's a terrific book.
Thank you, George. This was great fun.
I hope they make it into a movie. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, another tall Texan, unbelievable true tales with a guy named Stapleton Gray, who's also led an interesting life. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast.